coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Thank you so much to all of you who listen every week. Thank you all of you who have been listening for years. Thank you to our sponsors as well, especially our new sponsors, WebWorks Wireless. If you're trying to live stream out on location, if you're out there trying to get business internet at your home and you live out where you don't have hardline internet, check out WebWorks Wireless. They have some really, really great options out there. Unlimited high-speed internet for all. And I'm here to tell you, fully unlimited. As far as I can tell, I do easily 20 gigs of upload a month just with this show in 720p live video, folks. And I have yet to hit a cap. This show, you can see it right down there in the corner. You can see where we actively live stream to our website every week from WebWorks Wireless Equipment. So stop on by, check them out. WebWorksWireless.com is the website. Also, welcome to our other sponsor, brand new sponsor, our good friend, Dr. Catherine McGeorge. Stop on by her website, Secret to Everything, Alternative Health Frequency Healing, great things like that. Stop on by, check her out, SecretToEverything.com. While you're there, of course, stop on by our website. Down at the bottom there, you can see all of our upcoming events. Man, we are going to be at the Bigfoot Roadshow as a sponsor. We are going to be at the MUFON Symposium as a sponsor. We are going to be at the Texas Bigfoot Film Festival as a sponsor, looking at the Wonderland UFO Festival, all kinds of things. While you're online checking that out, check out the website of Dr. Mary Helen Hensley. We have recently been doing a lot of episodes about NDEs, and if you want to know about more of that, more about frequency healing specifically, more about how these things can help change and refocus your life, stop on by her website, MaryHelenHensley.com. Her books are Understanding is the New Healing and Promised by Heaven. Welcome back to the show, Mary Helen Hensley. How have you been?
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. I'm doing great. Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you back.
I'm so glad to be here.
As I told you in the pre-show conversation, one of my favorite things to do with this show is to demystify. A lot of people tune in and they expect to hear just conspiracy theory, things like that, because of the name of the show. But literally, it's more about let's understand how we got to this point. Let's understand how we got to this understanding, even if it's a mutual understanding of a quote conspiracy theory. And let's break it down. Let's demystify it. And we've been doing a lot of episodes recently. We just actually had Dr. Scott M. Taylor, formerly of the Monroe Institute, who is now using binaural beat therapy in the process of replicating near-death experience. And not only that, but helping people attain that replicated experience for a prolonged time. So really interesting. And I know you yourself have had the near-death experience. You have been down that road in life. And one of the things that I've been wanting to talk about, not only with abductees and other experiencers, but near-death experiencers is the other side of the afterlife, the when you come back, is it always a good thing? Is it always the fact that your life is changed and refocused for the better? Are there people that come back and they're tortured by this experience? You, as somebody who work in the realm of healing these people and dealing with people who have these experiences regularly, What has your experience been, with near-death experience yourself, and what has it been on this edge of the topic as far as people that are, I guess, troubled by it?
That's actually an excellent question, and I'm delighted that you want to talk about this because it's real. You know, it's not just all about the, oh my God, I went to the other side and it was amazing. And yes. It was. But like, one of the things that I am very grateful for is the privilege to be on the same circuit as so many of our near-death experiencers. You know, like I'd be out with the likes of speaking with Eben Alexander or PMH Atwater or Jim Bruton, who I mentioned to you before, Peter Bedard. There's so many different experiencers out there. And if I could tell you the late night conversations that we, you know, that we've had, because each of our experiences, whilst the outcome as far as what happened over there is extremely consistent, each of us in, you know, have had an amazing and transformative experience when out of body. The experiences when coming back were completely varied. Some of them very similar. And I remember sitting up for hours with Jim Bruton, who I want you to get on this show. I told you before. Jim Bruton was a foreign correspondent for, I don't know who it was, CNN or NBC. And fascinating, fascinating character. He's several inventions to his name. And he built his own airplane, two of them, as a matter of fact. And he was flying one of them and had a crash, and he died in a plane crash. I'm like, dude, dying in a plane crash, that's like the pinnacle for me.
Walking away.
Well, he didn't walk away from it, but he survived it afterwards. But his near-death experience was amazing. And he has this very different approach to explaining what it was that he saw. And I actually was very privileged to see him speak to a public audience for the very first time, which is always really, really interesting. Wow. When you see somebody sharing that part of themselves for the very first time. So we end up having this conversation after his talk. It was amazing. Of course, my Mama Helen is 93 in a couple of weeks, and she is a crackerjack, and he and Mama Helen are just madly in love. And he just thinks she's the bee's knees. And so we just spent a lot of time at this particular event. I think it was in Philadelphia with the International Association for Near-Death Studies. And but we had hours where we spoke on the subject of what happened to us in our personal relationships, which I think is highly important, when we came back. And I was dating my boyfriend from college, and Jim was married at the time when he had his NDE. And it's one of those things where, you know, it's safe territory to talk with somebody. It's not weird. It's not what it's just like, there are not that many people you can have this conversation with. Oh, by the way, you know, when I woke up dead, well, you know, what did my husband think? And so we got to really discuss that. And it was interesting because I was dating my college sweetheart. And so I'm from the South, as you can tell. And in the South, when you are still dating the guy that you were dating in college, your mom is like picking out the China patterns.
So when's the date?
When is the date? And everybody's ready for that. And so we actually ended up moving back to the hometown of my boyfriend at the time, which was Charleston, South Carolina, which is where my NDE took place, which of course is why his presence in my life was so important for many reasons. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. But can you imagine when you're with somebody who's been through that type of experience? Like, what do you say to the counselor? We got engaged actually right after. So like we were that close to the whole marriage thing when it was happening. And it was when it happened, like I knew immediately when I came back that this was not going to last. And, you know, it's not something that as a 21-year-old I could actually say out loud because I didn't know how to say it out loud. It started a very strange series of events for me as far as interpersonal relationships would go, because it was like I had this bizarre kind of autistic clock running in my head where I was like, okay, we've got 4 years and 28 days and 37 minutes in this relationship kind of thing. To the point like where when I was standing at the end of the aisle and the church was full of people and he was down at the end waiting, and my father looked at me and he goes, "You don't have to do this." And I looked back at him and I went, "Yes, I do." Even though I knew walking down that it was limited.
Yeah.
Now, can you imagine being the person on the other end? Like, it's unthinkable.
Now, I can somewhat imagine, and at least being in your shoes, because I myself, as I've told you before when you were on previously, as my audience knows, I spent my first year in college as a seminarian for the Catholic Church. Had served at the altar for years and years, served my community, things like that. It was a surprise. And granted, I was I turned 18 a week after being there. Like, I was there for a week long silent retreat before school started. School started the day after my birthday. I turned 18 the day before school started. I was already in the seminary by a week. So very much the same thing, very young. And it's one of those that, when you enter the seminary, people kind of fully expect you to complete that. And it's like, you know, that's a hard call in life. That's a hard call for an 18-year-old to make to begin with, much less for that 18-year-old to show up, share his experience about, I had an ecstatic experience with something beyond me that vibrated me enough and gonged my bell enough to bring me here to explore that connection more. And the realization of, whoa, why is everybody looking at me so strange after sharing that? You mean y'all didn't have this?
Mm-hmm.
You mean this didn't happen to y'all? And that was my first experience of, well, maybe I shouldn't tell everybody about that. You know, like, I'm a totally different person now. But you know,
I have to tell you, you know what I'm thinking of right now? Is the moment when I went to chiropractic school. Of course, that, you know, I had just finished college and I became a chiropractor because I broke my neck, and the chiropractor, Dr. Anthony Ross, literally saved my life.
Yeah.
Because I had every neurological disorder that you can think of, and they didn't know what to do with me. And so I ended up going to chiropractic school, and I'm just thinking now, it was quite my class was small and intimate, and I'm thinking of the very first day of school, and I'm wearing this hot pink outfit and these cowboy boots with these cactuses on them and these giant pink Hoops. Chili pepper earrings. I was like, the business. And remember what year it was, dude? It was like 92. And so we're sharing around the circle, and like, you know, it gets da da da. This is why, you know, this is what happened. And they're like, "And why did you become a chiropractor?" And I was like, "Oh, I broke my neck and died." And like, it was like, everybody turns, and like the guy next to me is going, "Well, I went to a chiropractor because, you know, there'd be corn in my poop because I couldn't digest it, and after being adjusted, I was able to." And I'm like, "Oh, okay."
You know? Yeah. No. And that's just it. And it's one of those much like, NDEs and the experience with the paranormal. The same thing happens with a lot of people that enter the seminary. They're, it's not always roses. It's not always great spiritually for a lot of people. It's hard, and it's supposed to be. It's there to challenge you and to literally make you realize that you are an unfinished pyramid that will never, ever, 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 ever be finished. Nor will anybody in your congregation. So level yourself off there and move forward.
I'm having such an aha moment right now as you're saying this. And I love that I can still have the aha moments. Because
I can still give them to people sometimes.
I don't know if you remember in the first time that we spoke that my father was a minister.
Yes.
And so what was so interesting was, of course, he graduated from the University of Richmond. And where did he and my mother go? They went to Kentucky so my father could go to seminary. So imagine, he's 22 years old. He's literally the same age I was when I had the near-death experience.
Wow.
And he went off. He gets there. My father was drafted by the Colts and went to seminary instead.
Wow.
Like he was pro football material. And I always remember him saying, you know, that he felt like he could be of a greater impact on the football field than he could in the pulpit. Mm. Now, he went on to become, he was a football coach on a Friday night and he was in the pulpit on a Sunday. But he never formally finished seminary. And I'm thinking to myself now, because it was he who received the celestial visit that was so outside of his scope of reality. Mm. When my mother was pregnant with me with the German measles, and the doctor was like, guys, you need to go home and get your head around the fact that if the baby makes it, it's not going to be okay.
Yeah.
And my dad, the minister, gets this celestial visit, and he couldn't call it anything else because these angels didn't have wings.
Yeah.
He described them as humanoid. They looked like us, but they didn't. And they came and they told him everything about me, including that I was going to be a girl. So this was in 1968, I think. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it makes me just wonder at 22 years when he goes into seminary, and you're talking about sharing that experience. Yeah. I'm like, I wonder if he had that same kind of push to go, this is not the place for me. This isn't where I'm going to, to make my greatest impact.
Yeah. And, it took me years to embrace the fact that I was not supposed to wear that collar. Yes, what I did as far as youth ministry, teaching, things like that, reached a lot of people. But what I was supposed to be doing is like what I'm doing now.
Right.
Where I'm talking about that universal T, capital truth, to people out in the regular world, and even to musicians that were up on stage and things like that, that, hey, they just needed somebody to listen to, man. They just needed somebody to listen to them, rather, you know, and be able to be there and not judge them for what they thought or why they thought it, you know, as so many people had done, which made them the way that they were in a lot of ways, because they were just trying to be them and everybody was saying, stop being you and be this, you know, which, yeah, it can be hard because, once again, I even had family that was so incredibly disappointed with the fact that I was only there for a year, that I didn't stay and stuff like that. And I know friends that stayed longer, and friends that had really, really tough times with addiction, alcoholism, things like that after. And it's very much the same way with these experiences with the paranormal.
Absolutely.
People can either handle the extremity of what it is and realize that, hey, you know, we all live life through a different filter, and that's what makes us unique. But when you're dealing with the trauma, especially the trauma of like, wow, I think I just died. Or I medically just died. This was my experience.
Yes. I can't even wrap
my head around that, doctor.
I want you to talk to my good friend, Peter Bedard. We are such a ticket when we speak together. Peter wrote a book called Convergence Healing. And why this comes to mind in this conversation is, so picture the scene. We're on the Queen Mary, you know, the floating hotel that's docked in Long Beach, right?
Yes, the haunted Queen Mary.
It's my favorite hotel in the world. I stay there as often as I can. And Peter and I were speaking at the same event. Now, we'd never met before. This is years ago. And I had just finished my talk. And I was walking all the way back to the end of the room when Peter Bedard begins his talk. And I stopped dead in my tracks and I turned around and I was like, that dude just took my material.
And he just stole my shtick.
He just stole my shtick. And I was laughing so hard. Like we call him my gay twin. He is my literal soulmate. I love this guy. And so he is talking away and our experiences are so similar, like that it's freaky. So like I was dying to go to the bathroom and I just stopped and stood there and listened. And so then he gets to this very interesting part and I'm mesmerized. And his coming back is completely different because I'm like, they may as well have sent me back in a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader outfit because I was like, oh my God, yes, I made it. Woo! And I'm like, Peter goes into this horrendous depression. So he was as broken as I was. He was a professional dancer. And so that was him finished. You know, I had just finished college and my degrees were in communications and graphics. So little did I know that I'm getting ready to get sent back to school to become a doctor. By my dead grandfather. But to do what I was doing, I was able to, after working through my injuries, I've been able to do what I do for quite some time now. But Peter, who was the business in dancing, is now finished for good. And he's got to reinvent himself. So not only is he a gay man who is now having to leave his surroundings where he has found himself and is comfortable. He's in LA and he is now having to go out and tell people, oh, by the way, I've died. So he has literally every albatross you could hang around your neck is dragging behind him, right?
Yeah.
So for the time that was in it. And so his experience took him into such a dark depression. However, this is what's so interesting. His life's work, the work he does now, what he's famous for, is called convergence healing. And it's the protocol of how he got himself out of that depression.
Wow.
So it was, you know, I'm sitting here going, see, it all has a reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you can't say that to somebody who is like, you know, dying again would be way better than this. And I'm so, and he'll just be like, I'm so pissed that I'm back.
Well,
you know, he was furious.
Well, and there is very much also that concept of, especially when you're dealing with addiction, anything like that, of you could have 38 interventions in 42 months until that person is ready to accept the parameters in which they need to live life to change that. It ain't gonna happen. Like you could push that Sisyphean rock up that hill all day long if you want to.
Right.
But until they're ready to affect that change themselves and in themselves and in the world around them, then the seed doesn't really take root. And especially hearing somebody's story like that, where yes, everything that they define, and I love the concept of convergence therapy of the fact of these two paths in my life have converged. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean the utter destruction of me and my paradigm, more the reconstruction of a new paradigm.
Mm-hmm. And for him to have brought that to the world, he had to go to the depths that he did.
Yeah.
That's just it. You know, get over it. That's what's happening, because you can't present an authentic ladder or a rope or a hand up to someone who is in the depths of despair unless you are speaking from that space.
Yeah.
Do you know it? Yeah. It's really interesting. So that's not, you know, my work doesn't really center around that. I'm this really kind of, all right. You know, Peter is if you're in that kind of, he works a lot with that type of trauma and with addiction.
Yeah.
And all. And what comes to me, that's what's attracted to him because of his experience. What's attracted to me is something completely different because I'm a mom. I'm also like super bubbly all the time. And I'm like, okay, I hear you. Let's get on. Are you done yet? All right. Now, where are we going with this? And so I am that kind of, and my father was extremely disciplined as a parent. My mother was that loving, wonderful. I was very blessed on the parental realm. Now, if you told 17-year-old me that, I wouldn't have said that, because my dad was, you know, 6 foot to Hulk of a man who was extraordinarily disciplined. And I spent my entire childhood, you know, either I was either at the football field or I was in church.
Yeah.
Like my, or in school. That was it.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of stuff now that I look back and go, oh my God, I hated that. But it was so necessary for what I became, because there is a discipline. There is an unshakable discipline required for the level of work that I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
Because people are going to be full of every excuse under the sun not to get well. And you have to be strong enough to stand in the face of that and go, I am not here for you to tell me that 30 times. I'm not going to take your money to do that. I'm not doing it. It's not happening. So we need to have a little conversation and make a choice now. And if you can't make that choice now, I'm not for you. And that's okay, because I'm not for everybody.
Yeah.
And but it's that sheer discipline. And then once I'm into it, my mother comes out in me. Do you know, I've got that loving, compassionate connection with someone, but I got to get to that space first. And my both of my parents created me that way. And so it's fascinating to see the type of, like, Peter loves being alive now. And like we have a ball together. And when we speak, and like, we're the greatest of friends, and he has a wonderful life, and everything's good. But it took him a long time to get there.
Yeah.
You know, and his experience with pain. I'm the kid who wakes up, like, I broke my neck. I have 1,000 floaters in my vision every single day, all day long. I'm deaf in my left ear. I was told I couldn't have children. I have two. I've bashed from head to toe. I'm now 53 years old, and I'm in a lot of pain, and I've been in a lot of pain for the last 30 years. But I'm that one who wakes up every day and go, okay, I know exactly how long I'm here. I can handle this, and there is nothing bigger happening in my body that's bigger than what I want to do today. And so I'm just that person. But Peter went through that period of, oh my God, no, I am in so much pain. I can't do this. You know, like, I can't tell you that I ever had any of those days back then. I was so happy to be back. And, you know, I was like, I got to figure this thing out, because they promised some big stuff while I was there. You know, I'm not going to miss it. I want to stick around, and I actually like it here.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing, because a lot of people who have NDEs will come back and they're like, I don't like this place. My God, you see this glory and you feel that amazing vibration of everything and that knowledge of everything coming back. And, you know, you're like, oh my God, the amniotic fluid, the amnesia. You come in as an infant in fantasy. Yeah. Oh my God. And then, like, so you got to walk around with that knowledge and then still play this game. And there are a lot of people who come back and they're not really happy about that.
Yeah.
So I just happen not to be one of those. And I'm actually really, really grateful that I'm not that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's just it. It's hard to process an experience on that level to begin with.
Yes.
Especially if you are not somebody who, I guess, is founded in faith. You know, I could see how having an all-encompassing experience, like a near-death experience, whether it's a life mission given to you or you just experiencing it and then coming back from it. I don't know how I would even reference that in my life without my frame of reference of my ecstatic religious experiences and my connection with the divine, whether it be God or the universe or what have you. But what I know to be that tug of the kite string behind my belly button when I walk in somewhere that's like, ooh, I'm here for a reason today. Like, I know why I'm here. I'll have to find it, but I'm here for something. And learning to recognize that. And, you know, there is that, I suppose, without a religious point of view. But I can see how having that harsh of an experience and coming back could be a paradigm destroyer for somebody if they aren't.
Absolutely, it could. And I tell you what's interesting, the universe doth provide always. And, you know, I have someone in my life that that is there every single day who deals with suicidal tendencies, suicidal thoughts. And while it is a big fat pain in the butt, and I will not lie to you, because it's just constant and chronic, but I understand what they're going through as well. But there comes a day where you have to go, as I've said, many times, what I call that dog food day. And people are like, gosh, this is kind of harsh. Until you've lived with it, don't judge it. Do you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, sweetie, I got to go and I've got to get some dog food because the dogs are out of dog food. And if I come back and you're not with us any longer, I am going to be devastated. I'm going to miss you terribly. But life goes on. I've got to keep going, do you know? And so I have a child who has been such a blessing to me as a human being to ground me. And people are like, what? Oh, my God, that's my worst nightmare. Really? It's really, you know. It's not. It comes in many forms from many different people in your life. And so I'm very fortunate to have had a child who came in with many of the same gifts that I had without having had the near-death experience. And so watching her unfold them and not want them and not want to deal with the fact that she'd know when somebody was going to die before they died or that her dad was gone and she grew up without a dad at home and all of the stuff that came on top of her that made her not want to be here.
Yeah.
And so to watch somebody access the depth of strength that it takes to wake up every day and overcome the choice that they made to come into this realm with only the knowledge, well, if I put myself here, there must be a reason. I don't know what it is, and I can't fathom why I would have done this to myself, but here I am.
Now, it has been
incredible.
When you say done this to yourself, explain that.
Done this to myself, as in the child recognized, you know, she's been living with me her whole life, so she recognized, hang on, there's something outside of this. You know, I didn't just, you know, it wasn't just the sperm and the egg came together and bang, there I was. It was, there was a soul plan that came here because she has memories of being in other places. You know, she has memories of being somebody else. She knows that she's not just this. So that's fact to her. So she can't unknow then that she put herself into this lifetime.
Gotcha.
As uncomfortable as it is and as difficult as it is, she's learning to go, you know, and so we had a long period of time where she tried to get out numerous times. And so as a parent, you look out and you go, oh my gosh, you know, wow, this is incredible. But it's no different than any of my folks I've worked with who've had near-death experiences who didn't want to be here. And it's been incredibly valuable for me as the one who I'm the lemons to lemonade girl. Mm. I can't undo that in my own personality. It's just who I am. It doesn't mean I don't acknowledge, though, that there are other people who can't do it. However, we've all got one thing in common. We all have a choice to be here. To exit this world is so easy.
Mm.
It is something that everyone has available to them 24/7 at snap of a finger.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing that we all have to remember with that. And so those who struggle after an NDE, that's no different than someone who struggles with suicidal ideation. It's no different than somebody who hates their life, you know, and just, but wakes up still and goes another day. Why is it? What is it that makes them stay here? There's that tiny spark, that little rivulet, that connection to that innate knowing that they're the ones who put themselves here for a reason. And even though they can't hang on to it, they can't grasp it, they know it's there. And it's that tiny little thing that keeps them from going,
well,
that makes them stay.
And for those out there who are listening to this, Mary, that have gone through this, that are feeling this way, what is the beginning of healing for them? Because that's what you focus on in your work is the actual healing of people after NDEs, the healing of people after traumatic experiences in life. So what are the steps to begin that process of healing and at least, if not finding mission with your newfound knowledge?
What's my purpose?
Because, I mean, the thing is, once again, you may come back from it and be like, well, what the hell? I came back with no purpose, man. Like, you know, you're straight up like 22 in the Disney movie. Like, I'm just searching for a purpose. Once I have a purpose, then I can go down to Earth. But until I'm assigned a purpose or have a purpose or find my purpose, I can't even be there and participate in that place.
It all starts with the choice. And that is the conversation I have with everybody, because I can't move forward with a single soul until they've made the choice. Mm. And that's regardless of whether they come in with cancer or they come in suicidal or they come in whatever they have, whatever is going on. Or I'm lost. I have no purpose. Well, you know what? I've never met anyone who doesn't have a purpose. And what they fail to realize is the fact that they've just shown up is their purpose. Where they are in that moment, in that exact time, is them having a purpose. It's been blown up into this grandiose kind of, you know, I'm pinky in the brain and I've got to conquer the world with my awesomeness kind of sense of purpose, as opposed to the fact that for some people, like, for instance, I worked with somebody yesterday just who has tried to commit suicide multiple times. So does it happen in every session? No, because it's not always about a past life thing. Okay. Often it's not, but in this particular case it was. And how fascinating that this individual who's here in Ireland ended up having been involved in an attack in World War II that left him in that lifetime in 1941, a young and vibrant man who had married his sweetheart and then gone off to war, and had left him quadriplegic. And of course she loved him dearly and wanted to be there for him, and he went, I'm not gonna do this. You're 22 years old and you will not be doing this for the rest of your life. I'm done. I'm leaving, and I don't want to live like this. And there was a scenario in that lifetime where there was an assisted suicide. She helped him commit suicide. And so coming back in, and it's so interesting because this person couldn't figure out it's always the same time of year that it happens. And it happened to be at the same time that this battle took place. That feeling would resurface. And so once we were able to go back and go, oh, you're experiencing a cellular memory that's taking you back into the space that you don't want to be here any longer, but that doesn't actually belong to this lifetime. It belongs to that one. Oh, and then you're trying to project forward. Okay, well, if I have an intimate relationship, it equals death. If I try to focus on my future in a career, oh, guess what? Everybody dies. And so you start uncovering, oh my gosh, the memory that's attached to the feeling that he's having right now is attached to a lifetime where that actually was the case, but it carried forward because it was a suicide, that soul came back in to push themselves to the utter limits of those exact same feelings under different circumstances, because the body is not quadriplegic in this lifetime and the circumstances are not the same. They're quite different. However, the feelings are identical. And what the soul does is it comes back to that space where it experiences the exact same feelings and challenges itself to make a different choice. And so just like that, and I mean just like that, up she gets from the table and the feeling is just gone. And is that my doing? No, it's hers. She did it, not me. All I did was wipe the window a little bit so she could see out.
Yeah.
And she found her way. And that's what happens. It's making that choice. It's going, okay, something outside of me, yet part of me, is taking place here. And I can either sit and wah, wah, wah about how much my life sucks, or I can go and find out what it is. And the choice is made.
Yeah. And I guess as with the choice to take any first step, whether once again it's somebody who's an addict or somebody who's, you know, taking the first steps in a spiritual journey, what have you, the first step's always the hardest. But once you're on that road, I guess, how do you learn to process the fact that, yeah, you may not have a grandiose purpose in the machine of the universe, you know?
All purposes are grandiose, well, sure. But in the illusion of the earth experience.
Yes, in the attachment that we have. In the attachment that we have. Let me rephrase that. Because
it's coming back and recognizing that you could be working on, you know, what we call a thread of lifetime, thread of experiences that are giving you a well-rounded 360-degree, you know, like this could have been multiple lifetimes where she experienced suicide.
Yeah. You're just weaving a fiber in the rope of your life right now as far as being a soul.
Which is a very grandiose and wonderful thing. But it might not be, you know, it might not get you a star on the Walk of Fame.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that's completely different, but in the soul's intricate plan, it's massive. Therefore, I can answer and answer honestly any person who looks at me and goes, I have no purpose. I don't know my purpose. You're doing your purpose. You're here doing that purpose. And that lost, horrible feeling that you feel right now and the way you're going to eventually move yourself out of it is your purpose. Mm. That's what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that I guess is where a lot of people might get tripped up, is the fact that the purpose is just you. It's it's not to change anybody else. It's not to work on anybody else. It's not to help anybody else. It's not to bring some insane knowledge from the other side to the rest of the world and a grand revelation that will change mankind.
Exactly.
It is to work on you.
Exactly. And people are really being confronted with this right now. You know, we got the gift of COVID.
Mm.
When it dropped in, you know, the whole storyline of COVID has given so many people opportunity to meet this face to face.
Yeah.
Because, oh my Lord, the judgments flew and the finger pointed, and it's on the scale. The storyline is different than what we would have seen, you know, 75 years ago in World War II, but on the same scale. The vibrational, the idea that watching families split without guns pointed in their faces.
Yes.
Watching a single, you know, the concept of something and our ideology around it, splitting a family, boop, just like that.
Oh, absolutely.
Splitting a community, boop, just like that. And that we feel like we've got to educate everybody else around us. And that's how people got really, really stuck in that frustration. And they were like, you know, I'm losing it. And look, I was guilty too. You know, it sucks you in easily because I'm just going, oh, please, guys, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, it can. And it can be really hard to not get stuck in that concept of thinking. You know, one of the caveats I give people all the time is beware of the phrase "those people," period. I don't care in what context. More beware of the person that says "those people," because that in and of itself is a distillation mentality that does not allow for the panoply of universal thought that may be going on in that literal individual's head.
Exactly.
So
it's like the culture of trying to erase history. Like, why on earth would one try to erase history when it is the very foundation upon which we build our future? And, you know, it's like, because we want everything to be the same and everybody to feel the same and everybody. And that's not how it works here. That's why it never works here.
Yeah.
So people can vote for that and march for that and do whatever they want for that. You know, do we grow globally as a community where we learn through processes where, you know, the vast majority of a group of people could turn around and go, oh my God, that's appalling behavior. Nobody should do that. Do you know? Yeah, we grow through things like that together, but everybody will never be on the same page because that's not what this place is designed for.
Yeah.
Therefore, we suffer.
Well, and I think that part of that suffering comes from the fact of our expectation, and really our expectation of well, everybody thinks this way. I remember not too long ago, a very good friend of mine, shout out to you, Wavy Dave, my old drummer from my old Grateful Dead band, his sister passed, and he was very, very worried about going to the funeral. Just internally, he's one of those like, hey man, you know, like grass is just the hair of the earth, you know, like has a very different view of the world and the universe and this beautiful, innocent view of everybody in the world around him and God, and it's amazing. And he's like in his 60s, but it's one of those like, man, if everybody thought the way Wavy Dave did, if everybody had this beautiful thought process. And he was afraid to go to his sister's funeral because so many of his family members would make fun of him because of his belief. They aren't really religious folk. You know, they aren't prone to going to, and he doesn't go to church on a Sunday, but they definitely don't. And he's like, you know, I'm just worried that they're going to judge me for what I think about her and the afterlife. And I was like, bro, if they do, just feel free to remind them that world over, they are the weird minority, not you. All right. Feel free to openly remind them in that space. Where they just called you into question that, oh yeah, don't forget, the ones that don't believe in anything are the actual minority across the globe, not the majority. So, and it does kind of take that attitude of what I believe is what I believe. And it not everybody, I think, is at that point. Not everybody is willing to accept that point, you know?
Absolutely. There's lots of people, you know, who don't want to hear the glories of an NDE, you know, when they've lost somebody that's very close to them. That's great that that happened to you, but I've just lost my loved one. I am never going to recover from this. I will never, you know, I hate life now without them. And I actually can't stand you or your story, even though I used to like it when my loved one was still alive. But now I don't like it because now they're gone. And it's really funny watching how people react to life and death. So a lot of people who've had a near-death experience will come back and they're just kind of like, okay, this is odd because I feel like I'm walking with a foot in two worlds.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are days I feel like that myself. I feel like I have a fairly good grip on 30 years of just sharing with people. Mm. Am I trying to convert people to believe what happened to me there? I couldn't care less. And that is a gift. I will share and then invited into different audiences to share that because there are people who want to know.
Yeah.
And I don't share it with people who aren't interested. It's not something that's there to force. It's just there to be. And that's, I think, the ultimate difference between those who had what we would consider a joyful or inspiring near-death experience and those who come back and are like, what the hell just happened to me?
Yeah.
You know, because it then might be the framework that causes them to learn and to grow and to seek and to find when maybe they weren't. For some, it might be a stronger framework that pushes them into what they were starting to do, but weren't quite there yet and might have fallen a little behind the plan.
Yeah.
You know, so for every single individual, it's completely different. I can't say in my own experience that I've ever met anybody who didn't ultimately figure it out for themselves. Mm. I know a lot of people who were troubled with it in the beginning. But then, like, it's something. It's so profound, that experience. And then you see the difference between this world and that. It's so clear when you see it, that it does and can cause a lot of confusion and chaos, but then therein begins that purpose or that plan to find a way through that and to dispel belief systems to demystify. I was telling you before we started recording about my time spent in Facebook jail yesterday. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
have you seen the light?
For Easter Sunday, the day that was in it, I shared my views on the fact that it's not hard to believe the idea, the story, the parable, whatever way you want to frame that up, of Jesus coming back into a body. He had what I'd call a Sherpa of the Spirit who was there anointing the body, praying, keeping the vibration high so that the body was able to physically and physiologically receive the spirit that had gone on sojourn for what we think might be close to 3 days. I have met different people who have had all sorts of levels of near-death experiences, from moments to minutes to hours.
Yeah.
I have watched people defy gravity, defy logic, defy physics. And it's provable. And so I was making this kind of comparison and naming off friends of mine, you know, who had gone through near-death experiences, myself included. And people, oh, that's great. Now you're comparing yourself to Jesus. And I'm like, no, Jesus actually took off afterwards, and I'm still here working.
Yeah,
so
Jesus
no, I'm
out.
Not comparing myself at all. Thank you very much. Either he knew a lot more than I did and was able to take off, and this is my purgatory.
He was no dum-dum, I'll tell you that.
Whatever, you know, but like he got when the getting was good.
That's it.
You know, I'm still here doing it. So
and
it's funny.
Exit
so,
stage
you know,
left.
And that's blasphemous. You can't talk about Jesus like that. Oh, yes, I can, because anything I know about Christ consciousness has an amazing ability to receive and a sense of humor and does not get offended.
Yeah, our overlord, the algorithm, doesn't allow that.
No, of course it doesn't. I'm like, oh, somebody else is offended. So I was speaking of this, and so I'm going, you know, it's not difficult for those of us who have been through a near-death experience to comprehend the idea that he could come back in. Sure. And, you know, and I went on to discuss this. Well, all of a sudden I find myself in Facebook jail, and the reason that they gave me was for human exploitation. And I am in the same category now in Facebook jail as human sex traffickers.
What? Human exploitation?
That's what they got me for. So I contested it. I contested it, and I won, by the way. But I thought, gosh, how interesting.
Yeah.
And so it's this idea that things are off limits or can't be discussed or can't. And I'm going,
maybe they thought that you were able to traffic souls from body to body.
I guess so. But I'm going, this is interesting because, you know, loads of my Muslim friends had put up all of their stuff about, you know, they're fasting during the day and then they're having their big Ramadan feast at night, and which is amazing. And then other friends of mine have like these, you know, a 6-foot guy in an Easter bunny suit with screaming children sitting on his lap on their page. And then others might be at a sunrise service, and others might be talking about Ishtar and the origins of Easter. Yeah. And I'm going, why this one? Why me?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when I pointed that out to them and went, are you going to take down anybody, everybody, or what's happening here? Immediately, I got out of jail. But I got put in jail, and that's the interesting fact, is that there was something there that created an issue for whoever that particular individual or bot or algorithm was. And I went, wow, isn't that interesting that I would not defame or defile anyone's religious belief, but I would contribute my own personal experience, and that becomes an offense.
Anathema. Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought, wow, how interesting.
Well, and a minute ago, I didn't want to interrupt you because you were on a really, really good point about meeting people at services and funerals and seeing that moment where you would love to talk with them, but you can't. And it just dawned on me the concept of they themselves have been through a type of literal near-death experience. where perhaps, they've been sitting in a hospital for 45 days, you know, things like that. And they have been literally suffering alongside this person. And it can be harder, if not as hard, harder than the experience itself, I think, sometimes for the survivors on that end.
Yes, and the NDE doesn't necessarily mean that traditional classic, okay, that person died in a car accident.
No.
This one died of COVID and came back.
Yeah.
You just reminded me of very dear friend lost her father, and she asked me, we had such a profound experience at his death, and I was in the hospital when he passed, and that's my favorite time, to be honest, is being present at a passing, or a crossing, or a death, or a transition. And she asked me to speak at his funeral, and she said, you know, he has a few friends left. He was in his 90s.
Wow.
And she said, he has a few friends left, and I would like to honor my dad by letting you share your experience of my dad's death and what happened in that room when you saw him leave his body. I want you to share it with those men because it might be the only time. And so I did.
Beautiful.
And here come these veterans at the end with their little pins on their coats, and a couple of them weren't wearing the hats, and they also were in their 90s. And one of them came up to me, and there were three, and said, young lady, I just want to thank you because it's the first funeral I've ever been to in my life where somebody didn't just read a nice passage and give a few nice words, but someone actually told me what happens when I die. And he said, I am near death. I am in my 90s. It is inevitable. Yeah. And he said, you just gave me the greatest gift by having the courage to tell that story. Do you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And we say it on this show all the time, Mary, that and I get questioned by people about, oh, why'd you have that person on talking about that crazy thing that they believe? I'm like, because I believe some pretty crazy things, too. Like, hey, I was brought up Roman Catholic. You want to talk about believing some crazy things? Come on,
Jack. I live in Ireland, man. I'm surrounded by it.
Bro, we got a book that's literally four fingers thick about the crazy things we believe, all right? And that's the book that says you better believe it or you're not this.
Or you're not going.
That's aside from the Bible, which, you know, for Catholics, hopefully, you know. Which I've always found hilarious. But it's one of those trying to get to the point of acceptance and like you said, those gentlemen being ready, so to speak, and having that they are near to death. Mm-hmm. You know, and their experience, and once again, even the trauma of those who have experienced death of a loved one and been there at the passing, because that can leave so many questions. That can be hard.
Well, I tell you what, if I've learned anything over the years, this is why I love doing what we're doing right now, this podcast, because I am a very firm believer that you and I are fractals of the same whole, experiencing ourselves in 8 billion different ways in this terrain alone.
Yeah.
And I don't have the answers to everything, and nobody who's walking this earth does. But the opportunity to sit, especially like in this podcast format, where I can have a conversation with somebody, where I'm sharing those parts of me and you're sharing those parts of you that are creating and ever expanding my perspective of what it means to be human. That's what it's all about. Therein lies my purpose. My purpose isn't to convert 5 million people, you know, to write 800 books. I write those books. Guess who I wrote them for? Me.
Yep.
I wrote those so that I could go back and witness my own experience thus far. And I know that sounds crazy, but that's why I write. I am witnessing my own journey. And what writing allows me to do is to step outside of myself or the pain or the deep connection to the stories and witness it as an observer. Mm. And every time I talk to someone like you, every podcast I do, every time I speak to an audience, I have that beautiful gift of that interaction with other human beings, which is rare and wonderful. And as someone who had an NDE, you realize that's the gift of being able to come in and be a human being.
Yeah.
And I'm ever so grateful, you know, and like for you for creating this kind of platform and for sharing your own experiences with me. And then this kind of banter back and forth where it's safe and there's no judgment and it's just.
Absolutely.
Just grand.
Okay, well, it's so absolutely essential. Whenever I used to teach junior high and high school spirituality, I always ended the year with, A, everything I may have taught you this year might be a lie. Go find out.
There it is.
I may have told you lies all year. Go figure it out. Go ask questions. The day you stop asking questions, you should be dead. You should be no longer moving the day you stop asking questions about any of it.
That's a good teacher.
And secondly, this is probably the most selfish thing that I do is teaching. Because whereas you had one teacher all year, I had 20.
Mm-hmm.
I got to learn from every single one of you a different way in which this material is viewed and thought about. And not everybody chooses to see the world in that perspective. Not everybody chooses to see every opportunity as a learning opportunity. Every opportunity is an opportunity to grow as an individual, to put one more brick toward the temple that you know will never be finished, that you will never be a finished temple, but you got to keep building, you know. And before we let you go, because I always love our conversations, I always feel very charged afterward. What can those who have had that revelatory experience, how can they begin sharing that? How can they begin to, I guess, really crack that nut for the world to understand in as soft a way as possible? Because it's more like pulling a scab off than pulling a Band-Aid off, you know? It's kind of like we had a conversation a few weeks ago with a 32nd degree Mason, and when you get up that high, you find out that actually everything that you've been learning since degree 13 is meh, you know, like really all you needed to know was back there. So the question now is, how have you grown from there to now? And how are you going to enact all of this now the way you should have been since then? Now that you know that. And realize the fact that, yes, you're an unfinished temple. You'll never be finished, but you got to keep building. So, how do people, I guess, start chiseling away at that idea? How do they start,
helping others? I think a great foundation for that is my favorite saying that has been with me since the day I died, literally, is, you already are that which you seek. So rather than trying to build a life around seeking enlightenment or seeking this spiritual growth, it's recognizing that you already are all of those things. And what you actually came for here was to get your hands dirty. You came here to get in it and get dirty, not to be this pious, creature of divine spirituality
or who passive sits back observer. In the
chair and looks at everybody and nods and quietly casts judgment and does it. You're here to screw up. You're here to love. You're here to forgive. You're here to embrace. You are here to struggle. But the suffering is optional. And I think if people can get that part, if they can understand that being here doesn't have to mean suffering.
Yeah.
You're never going to escape the struggling, because the way that this structure is set up here, and we're cyclic, and we've been cyclic since the dawn of time.
Yeah.
Do you know, and we're in a particularly interesting part of the cycle right now, which kind of everything that we knew to be true a couple of years ago seems not to be. And you know, a lot of us kind of knew that all along, and we're just, you know, kind of doing the dance as we go along. And some people are in earnest, really just seeing that for the first time, and they're terrified.
Yeah.
And so we don't need to sit back and point fingers and go, see, I told you, see, I told
that
you.
That solves nothing.
Open our arms and we embrace them like you would a child who's waking up from a nightmare, because they are petrified. And that is our purpose. Wow. That is the point of being here. That is a true teacher. And that is one who knows that they are a divine and spiritual being who has come here and chosen to occupy the mortal coil for all of the woes and all of the joys and all of the things that it offers simultaneously. That is your purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautifully said. Truly, truly beautifully said, Mary, because once again, not enough people understand that. One of the things that I try to get across to my son, who is about to turn 5, is fail a lot. That's okay. It's how you recover that's important. Mm-hmm. You know, and realizing that you can dig as many holes as you want. Just make sure to dig at an angle at some point. Mm-hmm. So explore, go check things out. Just make sure you got a way out. You know, make sure.
And if your parents out there, don't impose your fears on your children.
That's it. That's it. Don't Good impose, God.
You know, it's like. My daughter had her first gig up in Dublin last night, and she was so excited. But she's, you know, she's getting ready to turn 20, and she's in that kind of rock star phase of life and going on. And for me to sit back, okay, oh, my God, make good choices. Da-da-da. Look, she's going to be around people who are teetotalers. She's going to be around people who do drugs. She's going to be around people who are wasted and you're going to be throwing up in the bathroom and all that.
Yeah.
She has to choose who she wants to be on that day. And if I get a phone call, and I've gotten phone calls.
Sure.
You know? And the funniest phone call I ever got was from a policeman one night, and he said something to me at 3:30 in the morning. And he goes, ma'am, your child said to us that when she said this to you, your answer was, I'm prepared. And I meant that with all of my heart.
That's right.
I was prepared for whatever, because my job isn't to experience her life. It is hers to experience.
That's right. That's right. And it's hard. And it's hard even if you come back with a purpose to not want to try and impose purpose upon everybody.
Exactly.
You know, I think that's a big lesson that a lot of people piously on both sides of this coin need to learn.
Absolutely. And you, but also realize that for wherever you are in your own life, it's okay to set those boundaries too.
Yeah.
You can go, okay, look, go be you, go do you, and here's where I am right now.
Yep.
And I'm going to have to say no to this. Now I'm okay with this one. I'm going to have to say no, this is where I am. This is what I'm able to show up for. And that's okay.
Yep.
They're where they are, you where you are. And, in some cases, never the twain shall meet. And in other cases, you might find your way together through it. It might be bumpy. It might be messy, but it might be exactly what you came here to experience.
Yeah.
So enough of this nonsense of trying to make everything perfect. Like, you know, I pulled my kids out of mainstream school 3 years ago because I've also happened to be a little psychic, and I knew that pandemic was coming. So my kids got pulled out and put into their dream schools where they were doing performing arts. And everybody's what are you doing? And guess which schools didn't close down?
Yeah.
The colleges didn't close in Ireland. The secondary schools did. And everybody's kids went home and went on Zoom. My kids were up dancing, out doing their thing, and are now just as good as everybody else is, you know, 2.5 years on.
Yeah.
And you do you. You don't have to do what everybody else does.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, especially once again, just the topic of this life after the afterlife, you know, incredible to sit back and talk with you about this, because once again, I think everybody, whether it's a paranormal experience, UFO encounter, religious experience, near-death experience, astral projection, what have you. everybody looks at these situations with a pair of rose-colored glasses, thinking that, you know, oh, if I could only have this, then the answer would occur. And no, sometimes it leaves you with way many more questions than answers. And sometimes, it straight up ruins your life. You know, and that's a sad reality to know that there's a percentage of people, and it's not a small percentage, that it takes a heavy, heavy toll on them. And sometimes even the fact of, even if they don't believe, just not even being able to talk to somebody about it, mm-hmm. you know? So before we let you go, Mary, where can people go to get a hold of you?
MaryHelenHensley.com.
To come talk about it. How can they get a hold of you for private sessions? How can they get a hold of you for chiropractic therapy? Do you travel to Texas for chiropractic therapy? Can you do it over Zoom?
I can talk. Would you believe every time what's happened now is I've, especially through the pandemic, I did so many podcasts, that what happened was I started getting into the thousands of emails after podcasts. And wow. As you can imagine, for someone who is, I'm here to hurt it, to help and serve, it became very difficult because some of these things were very time sensitive and I couldn't get to everybody. There's just not enough hours in the day to do it.
Yeah.
Or else I'd be online 24/7 and I can't do that. That's not congruent with my life. And so I had to kind of go, okay, I've got to come up with something different. So coming up shortly, and I'll be sure to give you the details on it, I actually have a new show coming out called it's called The Mary Hellion. And it's just me doing it. It's actually really fun. And I try to cover a lot of the topics and subject matter that people would ask about in these emails, because I simply just can't do the one-on-one sessions online anymore because there are too many of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so like I was drowning, and it wasn't good for me because I was feeling like, oh my gosh, I just can't show up for everybody. And I didn't like the way it was making me feel. So I went, okay, you've got something you want to talk about and something you want to share. How can you do this? And so I created The Mary Hellion, and having a really good time doing it. I've got the first episode done, and now we're going to do 3 episodes before we start releasing. And it's just in a really fun and playful, Mary Hellion kind of, format. And, it'll be across all platforms, and it's just
awesome.
Kind of a show where I take people out on my adventures with me and we talk about things as they come up.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, and you actively have a couple of speaking engagements coming up, one of which you are actively the MC of. So tell us about those.
On the 11th of May, I'm at one of my favorite places in the world. I love the Association for Research and Enlightenment. That's the Edgar Cayce facility in Virginia Beach. It's near and dear to my heart because my grandfather, he worked with Cayce. He met him first when he was 15. And then he went off and became a surgeon and doctor, and he and Cayce consorted on some cases and all. And my mother is turning 93, and we are going to Virginia Beach because that's her father, and she's very proud of that. And so we're going to have a little celebration there, a little surprise party with our VA Beach family. And so that's going to be fun. And then I'm bringing her back to Ireland with me, and we'll be going over in July to the Glastonbury Symposium, where I'm speaking. And I'm just really excited about that
because
it's just so much fun. So much fun. So lots of really interesting projects going on, and a couple of new books in the works, and so all is well.
Well, fantastic. Once again, I can't thank you enough for always coming on whenever I contact you. You are always welcome on this show.
I thank you because I love it, and I really, really enjoy it's a real synergistic exchange, and I enjoy that so much, and I appreciate you.
Well, we appreciate you as well. Please do hold the line while we close things out real quick.
Absolutely.
While you're online checking out all of the amazing work and books by Dr. Mary Helen Hensley at maryhelenhensley.com, folks, make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com. Curiousrealm.com is where you can find all of the episodes. That's where you can find all of this stuff from our actual guests. If you go to the videos section over here, you can see that we have tons of videos from our actual guests from their YouTube pages. So if you're looking for additional content from our guests specifically, stop on by, check that out, curiousrealm.com/videos. We, of course, have the Knowledge Vault, all kinds of great things. Stop on by and download our free app. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the Internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. And welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much, as always, to all of our sponsors, especially our new sponsor, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. Stop on by her website, secrettoeverything.com. She has some amazing reading services, area clearing services if you have houses that are having issues. If you're wanting to learn to remote view, stop on by, check her out. That is secrettoeverything.com. In addition to that, make sure to stop on by WebWorks Wireless. They are our official sponsors for all of our website live streams. For those of you that have been tuning in to our live streams directly on our website and on the Curious Realm app, that is all coming to you via WebWorks Wireless. They have high-speed internet for all, fully unlimited cellular packages, folks. Anywhere that you get AT&T wireless service, you will get internet. And I guarantee you right now, I have been using this for, well, pretty much since the beginning of Curious Realm and traveling the country as a technician like I do, live streaming the show. I have been getting amazing, amazing quality out of it, and unlimited, truly unlimited. I am one of the benchmark people who's out there trying to put up like 20 gigs of upload a month through this thing is what I'm averaging, and it is yet to be capped. It is yet to be throttled. Stop on by, check them out. WebWorksWireless.com is the website that you want to go to. Our guest in this second part, Charles Christian. He is the author of Haunted Landscapes, Volume 1, Shuckland. Man, I have been reading this. I am probably about 90 pages into it right now, and I love the writing of Charles Christian. It is such a comfortable voice in my head whenever I read your work. Charles, how have you been doing?
I've been doing fine, and good to speak to you again, and especially on the new show in the new format.
Absolutely.
That's excellent.
Well, it's been a great growth path, as I told you in the pre-show interview, and it's been really an honor to have folks like you not only come on the previous incarnation, but on the new one as well, to come in and share your wealth of knowledge about the weird, the fantastic in the UK. The UK is such a hot spot for paranormal activity for centuries. I mean, one of the things I tell people all the time, whenever we talk about crop circles, things like that, 90% of the time within 5 minutes, we'll see a comment of like, crop circles are hoaxes. And typically my response is, well, the accounts of them go back to like the 1500s. And you know what they didn't have time to do in the 1500s? Destroy half a field of wheat. They were busy like fighting the Black Plague and trying to live. They weren't trying to hoax their neighbor and ruin their crop.
That is spot on. I mean, one of the things in the current book I've just written that became apparent is just how close to starvation people were in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, and you know, bad weather or a crop failure meant death for many people. So they certainly didn't go around ruining their fields.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just for like a family, but oftentimes almost entire villages.
Because
they were all sharecropping the same piece of land.
Yes.
And to give a little background here on this area, because once again, as I said in the pre-interview, just where I am in the story here, and we're going to be getting into the cryptozoology of the area, the cryptozoology of the UK, big cat sightings, specifically big black hound sightings, the ones that, you know, were the spawn of the Hound of the Baskervilles, things like that, and as well as Shuck, who gave his name to Shuckland. But just the area of Shuckland to begin with, and I'll bring up the map here so that folks can see it on my tablet. But it is directly in the line of this huge ley line that is just out of control, large. Oh, can't really see it there. But the things that have been happening in this area for years are stuff that would happen in big city medieval times. Like you have poisonings, you have plots against each other. You have stories of earls and dukes killing people. It's kind of out of control for a small dell of an area.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's forgotten now is that this part of the world, East Anglia, which is basically the counties of Norfolk and Suffolk, and anybody listening whose grandparents were in the American Air Force in World War II, they'd be familiar with the area because this is where all the American bases were built, because it's the bit of England that sticks out the most and is therefore the shortest distance to continental Europe. And so I say it was packed with American Air Force servicemen during the Second World War. But, you know, before that, it was very, very primitive, but going way, way back, Norwich was the second biggest city after London in the whole country. It was very wealthy. There was a lot of wealth from wool, which is why there are so many churches around here. So it's got a legacy history, if you like. It's sort of more recent history is a bit dull, but the latest stuff is really hot. The earlier stuff, sorry, is really hot. And this is where it all really started from. And of course, the other factor is this is witch country, as Matthew Hopkins, the Witchfinder General, was active in this part of the world.
Oh, wow.
So there's a huge amount of witch lore in this part of the world.
Well, and I mean, of course, that is where not a lot of people realize that we're pretty famous over here in America for the Salem witch trials, things like that. But the things that happened from the Malleus Maleficarum and the witch hunts that took place in Europe and especially in the UK, they were extraordinarily brutal.
They were. I think probably the Germans were the most fanatical.
Oh, yeah.
And they, well, this is where it was a German priest who wrote Malleus Maleficarum. But they were probably the most brutal. Strangely, over in the UK, in those days, Scotland was still a separate country with its own laws. And they were also very brutal. They, for the size of their population, they far exceeded the activities in the UK. It's just that in England, it's just that Matthew Hopkins, the Witchfinder General, just attracted so much publicity. Well, he was a self-publicist and spent a lot of his time writing books justifying his activities. So a lot of people tend to focus on that. And it's, you know, he's the one that's had movies made about him and so on. But I say there's one of the witch trials, which I mention in the book, in Bury St. Edmunds. And it just involves a couple of witches from a seaport town of called Lowestoft. And nothing really very exciting or unusual, except somebody took a very detailed note of the entire proceedings, put them into a book, which became a bestseller. And this was a book that the prosecutors in Salem used and said, you know, these are the ideas what to do, and this is how we do it. And they were particularly keen on this thing called spectral evidence, which basically means you can say, oh, the Wicked Witch came to me in my dreams and pinched me and gave me nightmares. And, you know, by modern court proceedings, that's just nonsense. You know, you know, it's not just even hearsay. It's something, you know, it's beyond that. It's just something you've made up overnight. But that was established in this English case, and it was then one of the key factors in the Salem witch trials. And indeed, the girls who were the prime suppliers of all the evidence, on a couple of occasions, they would come to court the following day and recount their bad dreams and, you know, bang another nail in the coffin of whoever was standing in the dock that day.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's Salem is probably hands down one of my favorite towns in North America. I lived in Maine for quite a while in life. My wife is from the Massachusetts area. And anytime we go up there, I typically try to spend at least a day in Salem. And I don't know what it is, aside from the history and everything else, but it is one of the most oddly calming places around. Really, really strange. Like, you would think that it would be unsettling or something like that, but it is eerily calm. And let's start getting into the cryptozoology of this area real quick, because I mean, even as I brought up the Demon of Dartmoor, this article was from 2007 in dailymail.uk talking about people seeing a black beast, things like that. So these are no strange occurrences for the area. Once again, the legendary Black Beast of Dartmoor is what the Hound of the Baskervilles was modeled after.
Exactly. You know, Arthur Conan Doyle used lots of factual material and legends in his stories as the sort of background to them. And so he was taking on an existing story of a black hound and just played on it and, you know, fictionalized it for the purpose of his story. But say there's a big tradition both of in English cryptozoology, both of big black cats tend to be known as ABCs, anomalous black cats, and there are sightings all over the country of them and have been for years, and the sort of jury's still out on whether they are some kind of lynx-like cryptid creature that's living in the wild, or that they are somebody's exotic pets that have been released into the wild, and, you know, possibly even that they've survived and thrived and grown. And so there's that thing, and not a summer goes by without fresh reportings of sightings of large cats crossing roads and things. And the other one is the black dog, the hellhound, and that is a feature which has been part of English folklore since the time of the Vikings, and it's suggested that it might be remembering the god Thor, because Thor had a hound with him, had a couple of wolves that used to accompany him around. There's also suggestion that the Vikings brought big hunting dogs with them to further assist them when they were attacking the country. And I say the Viking era went on for over 200 years. So it was quite a traumatic period in English history. And, the, you know, a lot of the language and the words stem back to those times. And, you know, it's something with us. And, again, all over the country, there are black dog stories in this part of the world. It's called Shuck. And, the particular area I'm in is called Black Shuck, but you will find other creatures called Shuck being referred to across the eastern counties. And, I say that the names vary, but they're all pretty much the same. A large, scary hound that either is a force of evil and, in some instances, possibly almost a harbinger of death. If you see the hound, then your days are numbered. But there are also, and certainly in this part of the world, plenty of tales of people saying they're a protective animal. You know, little old ladies saying they were walking home late at night and they were a bit terrified, and suddenly this huge dog marched along next to them and just sort of looked like it was on their side and protecting them. So, you know, it's got a sort of split personality.
Interesting, because it's almost the same way with Sasquatch here in America, where you hear tales of course, Native Americans, things like that, where it's a spirit of the forest. But you also hear stories where, yeah, people have been protected by them as well. There was even a case, all of a couple years ago, where I think it was like an 8-year-old girl was missing for 10 days. And when she finally came home, not found, like came home, she was like, oh yeah, well, I got lost in the woods and this bear took me to its cave and took care of me, like for a week. So it was one of those, like, wow, is this 8-year-old really thinking about a Sasquatch or a bear? You know, because the likelihood of a bear taking an 8-year-old to its place and that's just strange.
But an 8-year-old would be probably more familiar with what a bear looked like than a Sasquatch. Both of them are big furry animals that stand up on two legs.
But interesting how this critter, in either case, that normally strikes fear into people, in some cases is a protectorate and there to help people or guide them.
There was a story about a zoo, I think. I can't remember if it was in the UK, it was in Europe, or maybe in Japan, but a small baby fell into a gorilla enclosure, and one of the gorillas came and sort of stood guard on it until people, you know, help could come and rescue it, you know, and stop other gorillas coming in and playing with it too roughly. You know, it recognized that it was a helpless baby and stood there and protected it.
And even the folklore behind things like that is pretty phenomenal. How many cases are there in folklore of these black beasts being, I guess, not just a portent of evil or a portent of death, but a sign of being protection?
Exactly. And I mean, the thing with the portent of death, you do wonder whether some of that is just hindsight, and, you know, let's face it, we're all going to die someday. And you know, it just may well have been a coincidence that somebody saw it and subsequently died, as opposed to there was a direct connection in the way of, you know, banshees would have it go. But it is fascinating, and I say it's fascinating the fact it's all round the country. By that, I mean the UK, and it's been going on for a long time. You know, it's not some recent. You know, some legends are relatively started out quite recently. I mean, a good example is Slender Man or something like that, which people believe is real. But, you know, there's almost, you can set a date when it first appeared. And it's a sort of a creature of the internet. Whereas these other tales, there are stories of them going way, way back. You know, that, and you know, going back to your original point about the crop circles, I've seen woodcuts of, you know, medieval.
Yeah.
16th, 17th century, and it's somebody's interpretation of crop circles, and there's a little horned demon standing in the middle of a field.
Devil circles.
Standing in the middle with a scythe making the patterns.
Because who else would come along and destroy your crop?
Exactly.
Like, you had to have done something no different than, you know, sins of the fathers, or, you know, the fact of you've got a witch. In like, your milk curdled before dawn. Like, you must have a witch on your property. Well, or there's a crazy weather source coming up, something like that, you know, that changed the pressure and caused the milk to curdle. You don't have refrigeration.
Exactly.
You know, so those common sense things that we in hindsight can look at.
Yeah.
But, going back and looking at a lot of things, like, once again, crop circles, Sasquatch, these stories of black beasts, not isolated, not new, and been going on in not just this area of Anglius, but other areas of the UK as well.
Yeah.
For centuries. Yeah.
For centuries, yeah. And, you know, it's part of our folklore. You know, we talk about the black dog, and there's songs about black dogs haunting people, and black dog is a name for depression. And it's there's something about it that strikes the human psyche. I think that we're intrigued, frightened, interested, all simultaneously in it. There's something mysterious about it. The big black dog.
Well, and even the fact of, like you're saying, the acceptance of it, because here in America, we have local lore, we have local legends, things like that. Some places embrace them, most places really don't.
Yeah.
You know, most places don't necessarily want that kind of attention, crave that kind of attention, whereas it really is, whenever you go to the UK, something that is highly embraced. Like you said, there are songs about these dogs. Like, I guarantee you walk into a pub and mention the local lore or legend, and somebody's going to walk up with a pint and got a story about it.
Exactly.
You know, and nobody's going to look at them like they're crazy for sharing their story or anything like that, because they've all heard the stories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the town near where I live, called Bungie, where Black Shuck, the East Anglian one, first appeared, they have totally embraced it. The running club is called the Black Dog Running Club. The art club is the Black Dog Art Club. It's black dogs everywhere. It's, you know, it's on the town emblems. The war memorial in the middle of the town has a black dog on the top of it. You know, it's an intriguing little thing that it has been embraced, and you know, it's part of the folklore of the area. Well, it's one of the defining features of the area now.
Well, and I mean, so much so that the Shuckland, it is actively named after the beast itself. So
exactly.
You couldn't get, unlike Loch Ness, where the creature is named after the location.
Yeah.
You know, this is a little bit different. And now, was this something that, you know, did you grow up in this area, or was this area that you moved to later in life, Charles?
This is where I moved to later in life. I actually grew up in the north of England and near the area where my book, The Weird Woles, the Wole-Newton Triangle, was written about.
Yeah.
That was my tramping ground as a youth. And I've now lived about half of my life down here in this part of the world. And I was just intrigued by all the stories and, you know, the digging into it. And, it just fascinated me, as we were saying before, that, you know, there is just so much in this relatively limited small part of the country.
And in a literal rural countryside, once again, not somewhere like London, things like that, where, yeah, you hear about stories like Jack the Ripper and all kinds of stuff. But good Lord, some of the things that happened in this tiny little burg are like, my Lord, there's there's plots of espionage movies going on over here. People getting poisoned by eggs because you refused an advance by the king.
Yes.
It's out of control.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was fascinating. And I say, it's that thing of the more you look into it, the more bizarre it is. I mean, the story there is, you were talking about the poisoned egg. It's one of those strange things that apparently in medieval times, we're talking here about the year 1200 when King John was on the throne, people would give boiled eggs as gifts. This was something, you'd graciously receive. And I say, this woman who turned down King John's advances, and King John historically was an appalling lecher. No woman, whether married or unmarried, was safe. And he used to blackmail some of his barons that, you know, either your wife sleeps with me or there's trouble for you and your family.
Yeah.
So, he really was a bad guy. But, yeah, he sent one of his, when she turned him down, she sent a messenger with a poisoned egg. And depending on which version of the story, she either spotted it and rejected it or ate it and died. But I say, it's just intriguing because that particular story then goes off on a tangent in later years. And this woman becomes Maid Marian, who is Robin Hood's girlfriend. And, they all get muddled up because, you know, Robin Hood's set in King John's time.
Yeah.
And it all sort of links up with that. And she's on the run, and that's why she meets up with... why she's the noble's daughter who's on the run, because of lecherous King John is after her. And, you know, she meets Robin. And I say, just think from these little things.
Wow. Wow.
And I say the boiled egg, the town sign in the little town of Diss, that's spelt D-I-S-S, shows this incident. And, I was walking past when I first moved to this area, and I thought, what's this about? You know, it's quite clearly a man shoveling a boiled egg to this woman. And then I read the little plaque and then read a bit more and found all this completely weird tale.
Yeah, there it is right there, folks.
That's the one. That's him, yeah.
And hey. And, interesting, because we just got done with Easter. Yeah, the symbology of the egg and it being a gift and something rare is absolutely wild. And the fact that that is what happened in the town of Diss, according to legend, is just phenomenal. Now, you have literally made a career at urban fantasist. Thank you.
Urban fantasist.
Urbanfantasist.com. The stuff that you put out for the longest time with Weird Tales Radio, now Weird Tales Show on YouTube. You go into all kinds of legend and lore and folklore from the UK, which once again goes back and ties into Saxon times with the Vikings, Roman era. There is so much rich history of Britannia.
Yeah.
Your new book, I can't wait for. I cannot wait to read this because since COVID, I became kind of obsessed with alchemical documents. And reading alchemical texts, things like that. Very esoteric and self-searching is the best way to put it. But some of the writings that are in there go back to people like John Dee and Enochian magic and just the weave that happens in that area with alchemy, magic, wizardry, sorcery, absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. That's what I found intriguing. I mean, the alchemy side of things is interesting because although it's discredited nowadays as a scientific form, it really was the early days of modern chemistry physics, just as astrology was the early days of astronomy. And, unfortunately, I think with alchemy, there were way too many charlatans involved that gave it a bad name, whereas somebody like John Dee and some of the other ones they were serious researchers. And, you know, everybody talks about alchemy being all about trying to change base metals into gold. But it was really the Philosopher's Stone was really more about trying to work out what made the world tick and get down to it and to try and understand it all and make sense of it all, which we now understand is a real thing. And I can see on the screen you're coming up before me. Scientists have since beginning of the 20th century have been able to turn water into gold. Unfortunately, it's actually cheaper to go out and buy gold than it is
than it is to do that process
and the process in it.
It's just interesting because we can do all kinds of fascinating things now that we now know as science that at one point would have been utterly alchemy, magic.
Well, I mean, in the sense of, finding the Philosopher's Stone, well, arguably, the discovery of the atom and splitting the atom and breaking it up into all the elements it makes.
Yeah.
That's one of the Philosopher's Stones, because then you've got the building blocks, a bit like DNA as well, that there's so much you can do once you get down to the core science at the bottom of it. But in non-scientific times, olden times, that was all, as you say, magic or alchemy.
Well, and, interestingly enough, we just recently had Robert W. Sullivan on talking about Masonic imagery and Masonic symbolism. Some great, great research he has done into the Arch of Enoch, things like that. And the two run such similar paths, alchemy and Masonic tradition, things like that. And even to consider the Philosopher's Stone being that missing capstone, that part of the unfinished pyramid. The Philosopher's Stone is whatever it is that is the keystone that completes the arch that is you.
Yes.
That keeps you solid. And even going through and reading alchemical texts, they claim that the whole reason that their experiment failed was because of their impurity.
Yes.
Because of their unpreparation of self. I must not have been prepared within myself for this to be the result. And it's interesting because, so much of it was them distilling themselves in the process and getting down to what they were about. And even to see that in the light of that philosopher's stone, in the light of folklore, in the same way that these communities identify themselves by the folklore that they have, be it real, be it just folklore. You know, that is a part of the social and cultural identity that is the keystone or philosopher's stone of that area's culture and people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, when you talk about folklore and whether it's real or not, you only have to go back to, if you like, pre-literate times when most people couldn't write, which wasn't that long ago in the scheme of things. And it's very hard to draw the line between history and folklore. You know, one are legends, but they just may well have been historical events that weren't captured properly.
Yeah.
Whereas others are, you know, there were plenty of scribes writing it all down and carrying it forward. Yeah. And, you know, that's regarded as proper history.
Yeah.
And folklore is a bit made up. And it's really actually the same when you go into science and you start moving into the, well, cryptozoology is a good example, where serious zoologists won't have anything to do with it, whereas cryptozoologists tend to take a view that actually there's an awful lot of animals out there that we just don't haven't seen yet and haven't recognized. And as the years go by, we're discovering more and more creatures out there, and weirder creatures, and, you know, like all these things growing at the bottom, you know, in volcanic vents at the bottom of the seabed, in areas where previously you thought life was impossible. It gets there, and it goes the same with science when you start moving into, if you like, more the paranormal. Which again, proper scientists, and I'm using an ironic quotes there, say is all nonsense. But again, we're discovering that so many of these things that used to be decried as paranormal and not really true and made up or whatever are actual sciences. They just haven't been captured as efficiently as they were. But, you know, again, we're sort of seeing it with the move into quantum physics and the concepts of multiverses and ideas which are now being accepted as
absolutely energy vortices, all kinds of things, literal new forms of physics being discovered, new forms of matter. We have actually gotten to the point where we have created matter from laser light. That's one step away from a replicator in Star Wars.
Exactly.
You know, and I mean, I would just had up on screen last year during a pandemic when the world was locked down, Charles, 552 new species added to museums. 552.
Yep.
Like that's an average that we find between 500 to 1,000 new species every year. So. Feel free to take a look at any map of the U.S. at night. And to this day, half of it is black.
Yep. So, indeed.
And oddly enough, most of it in the range of Sasquatch.
That's it. You know, I'm a firm believer that a lot of the mysterious things that go on in the world, they're just things that haven't been properly investigated, consistently investigated. But that doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that they haven't been properly investigated. Yeah. You know, I mean, a classic is the, you know, going to cryptozoology again, is the coelacanth, which is an armored fish, which everybody would tell you became extinct 300, 400 million years ago, until live specimens were caught swimming off South Africa in the 1930s. And they're now recognized there's, you know, several different species of them. You know, so you can't write something off just because it disappears. And you know, the Loch Ness Monster. Another classic example. Everybody says, well, dinosaurs died off years ago, and it's possibly a plesiosaur, a sea creature. But, you know, if the coelacanth can survive, so can something like Nessie. And Loch Ness is one of the deepest lochs in England, in Scotland, I should say, in the UK. There's thought that there are connections through to the oceans, to open sea. Why couldn't it? You know, and Loch Ness is very much, it's up in the Highlands. That's definitely in one of those areas where it's at night, it's dark, there's nothing around there. Things could happen.
Yeah.
You know, same with all the black cats and the black dogs. Lots of woodland, lots of countryside, lots of things they can live on. I mean, we're getting huge numbers of deer now in England, some that have escaped from deer parks. Plenty of them around. You know, they're probably the most frequent roadkill you now see on rural roads.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Creatures like a big black cat or a big black dog, there's something for them to eat, you know, and no one would notice. You know, it's not like it was just farmers there and, you know, oh, somebody's eating all our sheep. They, you know, people would spot that. This is something entirely different. This, you know, no one knows how many of these deer are out there, and nobody knows where they are or where they've been or counts them. So, you know, there's a source of food out there for these mysterious creatures. So I say it's fascinating, and I think it's a classic case of the more we know, the more we don't know. You know, it's necessary to be open-minded about it and accept that there is some really weird stuff out there that isn't just bunkum. It is genuine. You know, mysterious, on the edges of science. We just got starting to come to grips with it. And, you know, scientists are becoming a lot more open-minded towards the paranormal than they used to be. So, you know, it's going to continue. And I think in years to come, a lot of what's currently written off as just being there, paranormal silliness, will be recognized as new forms of science.
Well, I would certainly hope so. I mean, the one thing that we talk about on the show regularly is the quote religion of science. Mm-hmm. And as someone who was brought up as a Roman Catholic and studied to be a priest, like, it's one of those, you almost see a doctrinal mentality when it comes to science. And to me, that's kind of scary because, I mean, hey, It was conspiracy theory up until 600 years ago that the world was round.
Mm,
it was exactly. It was accepted the whole world over that it was flat. And if you said otherwise, you might be like suspect to the witch inspector general. He may come that by and pay you a visit, and you may end up on a pike in the middle of town.
Oh yeah, that was heresy.
Yeah,
that was. I mean, that happened to Galileo came out with his theories.
Yeah, the church just non-excommunicated him.
Yep.
Like all of a decade ago, they were like, okay, yeah, our bad.
Yep, yep. Yep.
You know? And granted, you can kind of see where they were coming from, at least philosophically. He was teaching in the name of the church and had a great idea, but couldn't, like, prove it philosophically at the time by Aquinian philosophic proof. So if you couldn't, then you couldn't teach it in the name of the church, guy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, now we know science is a thing. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting how fast we lose concept of our own history in this right. And in the fact of, as a humanity, we only decided that this was a thing 500 years ago.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And well, it took open hearts and open minds and a bunch of people going, okay, can we just all like not burn each other at the stake for like 3 minutes?
Yeah.
And let's talk about the earth might be round.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's mind blowing. But
yeah,
that's what had to happen.
Yeah, but you are right. The scientific method and the science has become an establishment, and partly I think because of the nature of funding, and scientists want to get place in a university or a research center with tenure, and it's competitive, and you certainly don't want to scare off your potential sponsors and employees by coming out and saying, you know, I think there's something in these Sasquatches, you know. They are, if you like, self-censoring themselves. And, you know, you endlessly hear of scientists who come out with off-the-wall ideas being criticized, and then later they're found to be correct.
Yeah.
You know, and, the Trojan Wars, they were thought to be fictional until the end of the last beginning of this, sorry, we're in the 21st century now, so until the beginning of the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century.
Well, I mean,
when Schliemann discovered the ruins of it.
Yep.
And yeah, he got the original interpretation wrong because he wasn't an advanced archaeologist, but he found it and established it. And now we know, and you know, lots of other things are following through from it. And things like the biblical great flood, there's various theories about it, but one of them was that it may have been the inundation of the Black Sea area through the straits by Istanbul. A lot of that area was above ground, was above sea level, and water burst in there and swamped it all. And you know, the flood was really a tale of people remembering when there used to be people living there. You know, same with Atlantis. There's various theories as to what Atlantis was. But again, was it one of the island states in the Aegean that was destroyed when a volcano went off? You know, so there's lots of things that, you know, we're going back to where it used to be folklore and legend. Now we recognize it's actually science and history, but we've only just come around to recognizing it.
Yeah. And to really allowing it and to allowing the proposition, even now, Charles, to see the hard, and I don't mean a soft pivot by the media, a hard pivot by the media, the world over, in regards to UFOs, UAPs now. Before you would, you would see an occasional news article, you'd see an occasional news story, you would see the byline of, you know, UFO enthusiast or, area man claims to see UFO. Now you actively hear the term UFO denier.
Yeah.
Being used by me. UFO deniers say, and it's like, wow. Like, that's a hard pivot. And even just to think about that in terms of, you know, psychological games, that's a hard pivot, you know? That of anything, is red flag warning to me about things. Not that what's out there isn't amazing, but we really do have to watch the quote narrative of optics, because the narrative of optics is no different than a modern folklore. It's just being woven before your eyes.
No, that is precisely right. And I mean, you know, going back to Sasquatch, who's cropped up a few times in our conversation, we're now recognizing that the human evolution and the family of what's our species, if you like, is a lot more complicated than we first thought it was. You know, we thought, you know, primitive ape-like creatures, then Neanderthals, then Cro-Magnons, and, you know, modern man. Now we recognize that there were human-like species coexisting with us. You know, the Denisovans way out in Central Asia, we now recognize existed. You've got one here. The
Dragon Man.
Dragon Man.
Which is the latest one.
Latest one. And then there's that one about 5 years ago in one of the islands in Indonesia of the very small.
Yeah, the hobbits.
The hobbits.
The actual hobbits that were found near the Philippines.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's not as clear cut as we'd like to think. It's a lot more complicated. So, you know, that's three species we didn't know about, but we now know did, who were close to us and in some instances may have interbred with us.
Indonesia, sorry.
Yeah, that's it. Homo floresiensis. It's the island, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, what else is out there that's a bit like us, but we don't know about? And again, we have the Sasquatch in North America, but we've also got the Yeti or Abominable Snowman in the Himalayas. There's the Almaty, I think it is, in the Russians, Russia's Far Eastern territories.
Yowie.
The Yowie. Over here in the UK, we actually have something called the Woodwows, and it comes up in the book, which is another Sasquatchy-like creature. And again, where we still get reports of him being seen, you know, running across roads at night from one wooded area to another.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't just say, oh, yeah, it's all nonsense. The scientific orthodoxy says it's not true, because the scientific orthodoxy doesn't say that anymore. Scientific view is it's a lot more complicated, and there's a lot of stuff out there that we still don't know about. As you said, 500 new species every year are being discovered.
Yeah. And that's just an average, folks, of what's out there. Once again, that was 2021, like we were still in the middle of a worldwide lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a lot of research not going on. And once again, it's just one of those, we need to be open of mind. We need to be open of heart when it comes to things like this. We need to be willing to, because once again, there's stories all over North America, South America, Middle East of redheaded giants that actively ate the local population. They're in more than one location across the world. So really, really interesting stories like that truly do abound. And once again, the UK is just a hot spot for so many stories like that. And so many stories like UFOs, the weird, strange, fantastical, going back to medieval times. It's just, it's amazing.
Yeah. Indeed. Now, as I say, we live in a mysterious world, but it's also a fascinating world with so many layers. And it's, as said several times, it's all a lot more complicated than you first think.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I want to thank you for taking the time today to discuss your new book. I have found it, once again, more than enjoyable. Your writing style is just so comfortable and literally like somebody telling you a story. It's so great. Tell everybody where they can go. I've got your website up right now showing some of the new Weird Tales Show stuff, which is fantastic. Tell everybody where they can go, other than our store, to buy your books, keep up with all your research, and where they can keep an eye out for the upcoming book.
Yeah. Well, my website is www.urbanfantasist.com. and it's just lurking there. I'm also on Twitter at Urban Fantasist, and you can find me there. You can find me on all the links are on my website to everything. You can find me on YouTube at Weird Tales Show. And I think that's it. You know, the books are available on Amazon, either in print or digital format. And I think that's all I can tell you.
If that's as shameless as you can get, that is fine by me. but I seriously, I love the work that you do. It is so fantastic to see you still out there creating content, putting things out with Weird Tales Show. Make sure to go out there and keep track of that, everybody. Charles, please do hold the line real quick while we close things out for the show.
Okay.
While you're online checking out everything from Weird Tales over at urbanfantasist.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is your home for all of the episodes. That is your home where you can listen live on our app. If you're an Android user, you can download our free app and tune in live. We are getting ready to, if you scroll down to the bottom, you can see all of our upcoming on-location live streams. Cannot wait for the end of the month to go out to the Bigfoot Roadshow in Mineola, Texas. We are official sponsors of all these events. So come on out, join us, check out the live streams, check out the guests. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find everything. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the knowledge vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.